This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
You have Coach Pete Carroll is going to be joining John Clayton. That's going to be at 11:30 this morning. We've got Dylan Moore, Mariners utility man, who's going to be joining us here at the bottom of the hour at 9:30. And Russell Wilson yesterday with, this is the most Russell Wilson of all Russell Wilson quotes. Because in various photographs and video, Russell's been working out with one of the new fancy Oakley face shields, right?
Yeah.
With the mask, with the visor, the new state-of-the-art, cutting-edge, trying to prevent you from spitting and respiratory droplets falling on other people. So it's like, it looks like he's going to go with the modern age, modern warrior look, Paul, but it sounds like that's actually not the case.
He looks cool, that's for sure.
He does.
I mean, I feel like
face shields look awesome.
They
right?
do. They look super cool, especially the polarized ones. Now, apparently, you actually have to have a reason to get the polarized ones. I heard that from Chris Long on a podcast recently, which sort of depresses me because, honestly, I would try to find a way to get that polarized face shield there. Natron Means, remember when he had it? Natron Means, I feel like he was a scarier running back than he probably actually was because he had that visor. And it made LaDainian Tomlinson look a little scarier, too.
Also, the fact that Natron Means and Marion Butts played on the same team, like that definitely gave a little bit of one. Cam Chancellor, best visor.
Oh, yeah.
Like, of all the different players that have worn visors, and Jess chiming in with that, yeah, Cam's visor was awesome. Like, Cam's visor made him look even more intimidating.
Yeah, if you have some guy coming over the middle and he looks like Darth Vader, a little bit intimidating.
Yeah. Russell has been wearing the visor, but it turns out he's not planning to in the season.
Yeah, that was the Oakley visor, had the mask on the front. I've been wearing it kind of a lot of the offseason, just getting used to it. I don't plan on wearing it. You know, I'm old school in my approach, you know, and what I've kind of done my whole career. But if for some reason that I need to wear it, I want to be feel prepared. I always tell you guys, separation is the preparation. So I want to be prepared just in case. I've been wearing it for, you know, half the practices and half my training time, sometimes the full training down in California in the middle of the heat, you know, 90 degree type of weather. You know, it definitely you definitely feel it. So you get used to it, though. And you always have to be able to adjust in this game. And I think this is definitely, I think we've all had to adjust in some form or fashion and continue to adjust with everything going on with COVID.
Such a delightful dork. I love it. He has his survival backpack at the ready in case of an emergency.
And legitimately, he is practicing in a visor in case the NFL requires everybody to. So it won't be the first time. Like, this is right up there with him going to the Super Bowl his rookie year, like, so after the 2012 season, so he could see the timing of everything. And one of the things he noted was how long the halftime was. And so when they went to the Super Bowl the following year, he took a shower at halftime. Like, he went in and took off his equipment and took a shower at halftime because he knew that the break was going to be a little bit longer and he was prepared for that. Like, it is so delightfully dorky that he is preparing in case the NFL starts to require visors, it won't be the first time I've put it on. I'll at least have some practice time in it.
I had no idea that he took a shower at halftime of the Super Bowl. That is amazing.
Like, other dudes looked at him and are like, what? And he's like, he went and took a shower. Like, he went and took a shower.
He did that during the lightning delay when they were playing the 49ers and they had a terrible start. Then there was a lightning delay, and then they came back and dominated after that. He's like, no, we're just going to wash this one off.
Yeah. In terms of dorky preparation, the shower, the visor, and then the time that the snap came and, like, rocketed over him when he wasn't ready. And as he chased it down, he put his mouthpiece back in his mouth. That might have even been in the freezing cold game in Minnesota where it was like -9. But there was, he is, as he's running after a loose ball at a critical point in the game, he's like, oh, I should reinsert my mouthpiece right now. And now I will go and fetch the loose ball, pick it up, and fling it downfield for a game-clinching completion.
It was like a 30-yard completion to Tyler Lockett, who was doing basically jumping jacks in the middle of the field at that point. Because everybody left him open because they were like, there's no way that Russell Wilson's going to throw this ball.
His brain is just different. I really would like to know what it is like to essentially have the same blood pressure at all times, because that is Russell Wilson, I think, in a nutshell. Why else would you, while a snap is going over your head, not inwardly panic and have a little moment of anxiety? You're actually reaching to your mouthpiece and you're saying, okay, I'm just going to put this back in.
Jerry DePoto talks about that, right? The heart rate, controlling your heart rate, and that being one of the things that a closer has to do is when you're in this high leverage situation. He talked about it when we spoke with him yesterday, that Eric Swanson came in throwing 97 to 99. He's gassed up for the situation. He had started the season with the taxi squad. He gets an opportunity, and he didn't handle the adrenaline all that well. And Russell Wilson is kind of the exact opposite, that it's hard to tell based on how he looks in the fourth quarter how the game's going. Like, if you just saw a snapshot of him in the huddle, he pretty much looks the same. And that kind of brings us to the bigger part, and probably the bigger point of yesterday, is using his consistency and not waiting until the stakes are so high to let Seattle's ice-blooded assassin turn loose. That maybe let that guy go a little bit sooner, because he was asked, like, should there be more opportunities to run the good offense sooner in games?
The reality is that, you know, early in the games, you know, I want, you know, definitely, you know, rather than us having it be in the fourth quarter, I think to be able to, you know, make some stuff happen. I think we have a crazy stat of the lead of, you know, I think 56-0 when we have the lead, you know, by halftime and stuff like that. I think, you know, getting ahead is a key thing. You know, I definitely believe in finishing strong. I think we've won a lot of games in the fourth quarter, you know, do some fun things in the fourth quarter and in the games, but let's treat every quarter as the fourth, you know, and I think that's kind of my mentality always.
He clearly thinks about it, and he obviously sees the let Russ cook crowd as well. Do you think there's any friction between him inwardly and the way that the Seahawks have run things offensively?
Not more so than a normal. It's not an unusual amount of friction. I think there's always friction between players and coaches. I think there's always the question,
especially quarterbacks and coaches. I mean, we saw it with Brady and Belichick. That's why that thing ended.
Like, there's, and it's not even, so, is he fed up with it? No. Does he want to do more earlier in games? Yeah, I think he does. Yeah, I think that he'd prefer them go out and be aggressive earlier and have more throws downfield on early downs and not play field position for the first quarter and a half, which is what it seems that Seattle is very content to do. Pete Carroll's MO is to get games into the second half. Hey, keep it close and get to the fourth quarter and then we'll turn it loose. And there, it's hard to argue with the results of it. The question that I have is that the best way to go about it with the team you have right now? Isn't the best way, if you're going to make the most of having the one of the top two or three quarterbacks in the league, isn't that to give him the most chances to make those sort of game-deciding plays and not keeping it close to the vest until the fourth quarter?
Yeah, it makes sense to give him more opportunities, but this year is different, and it's not just because we're living in unprecedented times and are trying to adjust to the new normal. It's because the Seahawks offensive line is going to be with four out of its five players possibly being new starters. At the very least, you've got three. One of them's turning 35 this year and coming off knee surgery. Russell Wilson's been sacked 99 times the last 2 years. And the thing that the Seahawks do best in their passing game is setting the defense up by lulling them to sleep with all of those handoffs up the middle to Chris Carson and all of those handoffs to the outside to someone like Rashad Penny. Maybe it's Carlos Hyde this year. It gets them lulled into a false sense of security so that you can still hit them over the top with a play-action fake pass down the seam to a Will Disley or down the field to Tyler Lockett. And you still have to make sure that you're keeping those defenses honest. And, you know, if you turn it into something where you're just spreading things out the way that Patrick Mahomes does, fine, okay, it might work with Russell Wilson, but you don't have the same weapons that Kansas City does. You don't have the same offensive line Kansas City does. Mahomes only got sacked 17 times last year, and that is something that I wonder about. Mahomes holds the ball a little while himself, too. It's not like he just gets rid of the ball super quickly. My big concern, Danny, this year is that this offensive line is going to fail Russell for the first time, and that this could be, knocking on wood, the first time that he actually misses a game or two, because that unit in front of him, it is, I think, the worst that it's ever been.
It's been so bad. That's such a low bar. Like, that's such a low bar. There's a lot of confidence. I don't think it's going to be good. I don't know if it's going to be significantly worse. And I think that the sack totals really reflect in part how Russell plays.
True.
That in part of that, it is just how Russell plays in holding on to the ball. I do think that you're going to see them, if anything, because of the fact that there is no preseason, that they are going to be more conservative and try to run the ball more early in games. I also wonder about the availability. Right now, Chris Carson wasn't there and hasn't been there this week because he's dealing with a family situation. Rashad Penny's on the physically unable to perform list. I don't think anybody's expecting him to be available when the regular season starts. You have Carlos Hyde. You have DJ Dallas, the rookie, and Travis Homer, who Pete's trying to gas up as well. But early in the season, it actually might be, I think every pass should be play action pass, because I don't think, and I haven't seen any evidence to show me that play action actually depends upon the success of the running game. And people have studied it a lot. There's no correlation between being able to run the ball successfully, making play action more effective. And it sounds counterintuitive, but I mean, statistically, and the people that look at the numbers, they're not related. There's no proof that when you're running the ball, you're then able to throw better play action pass because the defense is looking for the run.
And I understand that argument, but there's also something to be said for if you are a defensive player and you have studied all week long and you're making your keys going into the game, there are certain players that you are going to pay extra attention to. When the Rams were good and they had Todd Gurley not dead, they were probably looking at Todd Gurley when the Seahawks were getting ready for those games and thinking, okay, well, this guy can catch passes out of the backfield on plays that he actually has a play action fake to him. This is that is the kind of player that a Todd Gurley is. And I do think that for certain players, quarterbacks and for running backs, defenses are more worried about certain elements on a given play. I think it's natural to have just that little bit of apprehension or anxiety or that thought that you might freeze or have to aggressively react to something in such a split-second decision kind of league. I think there is more to it than what the numbers indicate. I think there is a mentality side of things that play action certainly affects players with.
What if Russ just goes rogue? If he gets out there and says, that's all well and good, but
like
we got Skynet. We got some opportunities that are here. Like, let's go. We're gonna throw the ball on early downs here. It's still be an interesting season to see how Seattle, because I think that the addition of Jamal Adams is going to make Pete believe that their defense is back to, and he can play the style of game that he wants to play. And I feel like their best chance at winning is going to be not trailing at halftime so much. They trailed at halftime 10 times last season, and they either need to allow fewer points or score more points in the first half, because I don't think you're going to win 11 games if you trail at halftime of 10 games again. And I think their best chance is to score more points in the first half than it is to focus on allowing fewer.
I hope that that's the case. I really hope that Pete Carroll can now dial up the fastball on the defensive side of things and do some fun things. Because I bet there is an element of Pete, too, that wants to be able to cook defensively and has realized over the last couple of years there is only so much he can do on that front. So what would we say? We have something for Bobby Wagner. Feed Bobby Wagner, right? What are we going to have as the saying for Jamal Adams to get Jamal Adams involved?
Unleash the Kraken. Oh wait, that's a hockey team. What's a suggestion for a call? If it's let Russ cook, feed Bobby Wagner, what is it for Jamal Adams? Text in 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. Right now, it's time for us to go around the NFL.
It's time to go around the NFL. Brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. The bottom line on the biggest stories in the NFL every morning at 9:15 with Danny and Gallant.
Today's an exceptional day.
Yes.
Happy Friday, everybody. The Chiefs officially signed Travis Kelce to a four-year extension worth $57 million. $28 million of that is guaranteed. How do they have money?
It's a good question. They basically had, I read at one point this offseason, they had $179 in cap space. Like, they were as tight to the cap as you can possibly get. Now they've gotten extensions to Chris Jones,
Mahomes,
Patrick Mahomes, and Travis Kelce. You just kick the can down the road. At some point, the credit card bill is going to come due for them. They're probably not going to be able to make additions for a while. And like they're probably they're probably, this is the group they got, and they're going to try to hold on to it as long as they can.
So maybe they should tone it down with the talk of five championships and dynasties. This will, you're right, eventually all hit a point where the where the Chiefs can't get any better. I want to focus on the Kelce contract for a second because the George Kittle contract happened yesterday as well. I like both of those players. I think they're worth it. I think that when you have tight ends like that, you should pay them a little bit more. But I do find it interesting that there is not as much criticism for these two contracts as you see for guys like Christian McCaffrey, seeing as tight ends play a more violent position than running backs do. Blocking every single play, you're running over the middle.
Wait, you just said a more violent position than running backs?
I think tight
ends... Nobody plays a more violent position than running backs.
I think tight ends do. You're running...
Really?
You're blocking guys who are bigger than you when you're blocking. You're running over the middle of the field, laying yourself... possibly open for a safety to just clobber you while you go over the middle. Yeah, you are defenseless more often as a tight end than you are as a running back, that's for sure.
Dude, 11 guys are trying to tackle you every time you have the ball as a running back. And some running backs get the ball as many as 15, 20 times a game.
If you're a tight end, you might get clobbered over the middle and concussed, and you are expected to just get back up. I think that, and then you're going up against a 300-pound defensive lineman on a regular basis, too. Like, you might just hurt your shoulder, basically, doing stuff like that. So, I think that there is about as much contact that those two positions face. It's different, and you're right, that a running back has a bunch of guys chasing after him on any given play. But tight ends, there's a lot of car crashes for that position. And, I mean, we saw with Rob Gronkowski, when it all of a sudden leaves you, it leaves you pretty quick.
Bill Belichick gives his first impression of Cam Newton, calling him a hardworking kid.
This is going to be funny to watch how micromanaged that relationship is. I get the feeling that they're probably going to get along way better than people think they get along. Because I think so many people are going to be looking for any sign of how... I think that's going to be a pretty straightforward... Cam's there to restart his career, and Bill Belichick's there to basically hold him as accountable as he does every single player. I think that relationship's going to work out fine. Am I wrong?
No, I think it's going to be fine, too. I think that this is refreshing for Cam Newton. He wants to prove himself this year, and maybe this isn't something that would work over a couple of years, but I think he's got a massive chip on his shoulder, and to have a guy like Bill Belichick who is going to be pushing him in the right direction is probably the best thing that he could ask for. So I'm curious as to how this lasts over the course of an entire season, but right now this is going to be, I think, quite the honeymoon phase leading up to the year.
I'm on record. I want the Patriots to go 4-12 and the Bucks to go 5-11, so Tom Brady can win, but both sides can lose. If that doesn't come to pass, if the Patriots turn out to be good, I hope Cam Newton is awesome, and I hope that he signs a long-term extension, and then I hope he proceeds to become the most egotistical quarterback that we've ever seen in the world, and that does truly test Belichick, because I don't think it'll happen this year. When he's honestly going to be playing for a long-term contract, but that would be my wish.
Do you think the Patriots would sign him to an extension?
I don't know, because I think that you would look at that is it's much different to have him on a one-year prove-it deal than it is to sign him to a multi-year big-budget extension.
I agree with you on that front. That's what I'm most curious about, because there's a good chance that New England's like, all right, yeah, we're going to try to find that young next quarterback. But I also think there's an element of the Patriots being really excited about having a quarterback that can actually move, because they've never had that.
This coming from the Wall Street Journal, minority owners in Washington's football team are reportedly pressuring Dan Snyder to sell. Do you think that will ever, ever happen?
It's an interesting dynamic. I don't want to say never. The trouble with how much those guys, because the minority owners own like 40%. And the problem is that it's extremely, like, that's worth a lot of money, but nobody wants to own the minority of a football team. Like, if they want to pay that much money, they want to actually make the decisions. But look, there's a lawsuit that's come up where basically Snyder is inferring that one of those co-owners has funded some of the media leaks that have resulted. Like, it's a huge mess. It has not been resolved by them saying they're going to be the Washington football team. And look,
it's given the Wolves more ammunition, right? I mean, now they smell blood and they are going to tear him apart. I just don't think that he's going to be able to survive this. They're going to keep looking and looking and looking for more ways to expose him as a bad owner now that they've finally been able to show that there was this bad culture in Washington for a long period of time.
He's rich enough to sit it out, though, isn't he? Like, if he's adamant, he's not one of these guys that owns, like, 5% of the team and has this huge, like, it's his money that owns most of it.
But it's been 20 years of bad.
Dude, but I think he's rich enough to be that bad, though. It's America. Like, if you're rich enough, you can be as insufferable as you want to be, and there's not much people can do to you. He might be rich enough.
But it
just need his wife to declare him incompetent.
Seriously, like, I mean, think about how hard it was, all of the things that Donald Sterling did over all of those years, and how they finally got him out of there was his wife getting him declared mentally incompetent.
If you want justice for the American sports fan across the United States of America, you are rooting for Washington to find a way to force Snyder out.
I don't know about that. There's part of me that kind of enjoys him bringing destruction and ruin to a loyal fan base. Like, there's a little bit, because it's not
they've
like my
enough.
Heart bleeds. It's not like my heart bleeds for Washington football fans.
Mine doesn't either, but they've had enough. They have had enough. This was a good organization at one point. Now
yeah.
it is one of the laughingstocks of the league. You see this with owners across sports.
That's how it goes sometimes.
I know, but look, this might be the only way, Danny, that we can remove bad owners from their teams. You need to set a precedent, and this would be quite the precedent. Remember when this team was the most valuable franchise in sports? It wasn't that long ago. In fact, they still might be somehow, which would be an honest miracle if that was the case.
That is Around the NFL. Remember, our two-a-days are starting on Monday from 11 a.m. to noon. Somebody, one of our Seahawks experts, will be joining John Clayton to talk about everything that's happening out there. And then in the afternoon, you'll have one of our hosts having a video chat on 710sports.com to answer all of your questions. Paul Gallant's heading out there to Seattle practice later today, where we think there's going to be the first team drills, where you have offense and defense kind of at least going through drills against each other. Coming up next, Dylan Moore, Mariner infielder, whose, well, his power has made quite an impression. He joins us as the Mariners start a series in Houston. That's next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Waiting on Dylan Moore. We'll talk to the Mariners infielder, all-purpose utility guy. The Mariners getting set to take on the Houston Astros. First pitch tonight at 6 p.m. with the pregame show starting right here, 710 ESPN Seattle at 5. Ramon Laureano, who was suspended 6 games for charging at the Astros dugout. That suspension's been reduced to 4 games, and he's going to start serving it tonight. So he's not going to miss any division games, but from 6 games down to 4 games. Paul, as I've looked across, as teams are opening training camp across the NFL, it's interesting to see the number of who expects to have Super Bowl expectations. Because clearly, Kansas City is the heavyweight in the AFC, right?
Yes.
I mean, they're probably even a cut above. They've now re-signed to extensions Chris Jones, Patrick Mahomes, and Travis Kelce in this offseason. Like, they're loaded up and ready to go. Who's the favorite in the NFC?
I would say New Orleans, if not for Drew Brees turning into a pumpkin at the end of the last couple of seasons. And I
right.
think that is a concern that it could happen earlier this year. And I don't know that Taysom Hill is going to make you feel better about your passing game if you're New Orleans. I do like them bringing in Emmanuel Sanders, though.
Is San Francisco the favorite?
No. No. Too many losses this offseason, I think. I think losing to Forrest Buckner via trade, mm-hmm. I think that Deebo Samuel dealing with the Jones fracture is going to be a problem. They're looking right now at wide receivers like Tavon Austin to bring in because of the depth that they currently have. That might work out, given that he has always been looking to be that little speed sweep, jet sweep wide receiver. It's hard to say San Francisco because there are some arguments to be made that they might be due for a regression themselves, especially if you take a look at the back end of their defense.
And now we are joined by Dylan Moore, who's in Houston with the Mariners, who will be taking on the Astros tonight. Dylan, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
It's got to be an exciting start for the year for you, and the opportunities that you've gotten really all over the field, and then the pop that you've been showing at the plate. How's the past 3 weeks gone for you?
Awesome. They've been good. Everything that I've worked for in the offseason and tried to better upon myself and in my game in the offseason has showed up so far this year. I just want to be able to keep that going throughout my opportunities here.
Was crushing the ball a priority because you've been doing that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wanted to get stronger, and I wanted to be able to hit the ball with more consistency. I saw a little bit of power last year with obviously a lot of in-between there with some strikeouts and stuff like that. So I just wanted to be more consistent and then hit it harder with more consistency, I guess.
Now, Dylan, in looking back kind of through your history, I'm interested in what made you choose the Mariners, because you signed with them in 2018, kind of November of that year, and the next year you make the opening day roster. Was that kind of a calculation on your part that you thought the opportunity was good? Was it what they said to you? What made you choose Seattle?
Well, I was a minor league free agent at the end of 2018 year, and in the offseason I was playing in Mexico, and I got a call from my agent who said that Jerry was on the line, and said he liked everything that he saw and he wanted to give me a chance at the big league club. And I thought that was a great opportunity, considering the year before that I had actually gotten released by the Braves after minor league camp was over. And so coming off of a good year in Double A and Triple A with the Milwaukee Brewers in 2018, we had a plan. We knew what we wanted. Coming out of minor league free agency, that was probably the best thing that could have happened, a major league deal, and so it didn't take long before I really went for it.
Did Jerry tell you what he thought you could be?
I mean, we discussed that it would be I would be competing for the utility role in that first year out of spring training, and obviously, with my limited experience in the big leagues, or none to that point, that I would be, you know, just competing, and that he saw that my value was I could play a lot of positions and have a decent niche in the big leagues and just go out there and play. And I was fortunate enough to break it last year and go to Japan and just have an awesome experience and learn a lot in the big leagues last year.
We're talking to Dylan Moore here. I love kind of stories like yours, Dylan, where, I mean, a couple years ago, you've probably got a question about where things are headed, and now you're on a big league roster, and you're sort of showing your value and finding that niche, which is going to be extremely valuable here for the Mariners as this utility player. As you were going through that and playing in Mexico after getting released, did you wonder if the big leagues were ever going to happen for you?
Well, the Mexico thing was actually after I had a pretty decent season with the Brewers. The year before that, I was let go out of spring training, and it was only a couple of days before that I got picked up by the Brewers. But those couple of days, yeah, sure, I was definitely wondering what, questioning obviously if I was good enough, you know, if this was the right thing for me, and was it the right thing to put my family through for another, you know, amount of years without the, you know, the dollars really being there. And so, yeah, it was definitely a thing. I knew that I was good enough. Obviously, when you get fired from anything, you know, there's some doubt in your mind. But I knew that if I worked hard enough and I knew I had a good plan, I just kind of had to stick with it. Just a minor bump in the road there that I could, you know, overcome this minor obstacle and turn into the player that I knew that I could be.
Did you have to learn Spanish really quickly?
So I knew a little bit of Spanish. My wife is from Puerto Rico. We met when I went to UCF in 2015. We met. Oh, no, excuse me, 2013 we met. And I've been learning Spanish from her for some time now. And every time I get around some Latin players, and definitely in Mexico there, it gets a little bit better. So I didn't have to learn it quickly. I had to re-up on it a little bit.
Can you roll your R's?
I can do it in the proper setting.
Good for you. That's hard, man.
I want to ask about the team name. that you played in Mexico. You have the good year with Milwaukee, and as Jerry DePoto calls you, you're playing for the Tomateros?
Yeah, Tomateros. Yeah, the Culiacan Tomateros. It was a fun couple months there. It's a different game. Very long games, but it was definitely very fun.
What's been the difference for you this year? Like when you look at the start you've gotten off, the pop that you've shown, what would you say the difference has been in whether it's approach or strength? What's made this difference for you?
It's a variety of things. I think one of the major things is specifically offensively is last year I had a lot of swing and misses and foul balls. And I think that this year when I'm getting my pitch to hit, I'm hitting it. And I know that in the big leagues and any type of baseball, but especially in the big leagues, if you miss that first good pitch to hit, it's going to be a tough AB the rest of the way. And because, you know, these guys, they see that you take good hacks at a pitch and, you know, you don't see it for the next couple of games maybe. So adjustments on that part, when I get a pitch hit, to be on time, to be ready to hit it, and to hit it hard. And the harder you hit it, the basically more likely you're going to be able to get a hit. So that's probably one of the main things for me that's been doing well so far this year.
It's got to be fun to be a part of this top of the order where you're batting second, you either have Kyle Lewis or Kyle Seager behind you, take your pick. I mean, that has become quite the formidable power trio this year.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's so much fun hitting at the top lineup. Let me tell you, JP getting up there and doing what he does, getting on base, and then I know I got guys behind me. It's a very comfortable role. I've always loved hitting second, first, or whatever, because I know what I have to do for these guys behind me, and to know that there's guys behind, and when you get your opportunity to drive guys, then obviously do it, but you know that you got to get on base and get in scoring position for these guys. They can really swing it, and that's their job. So everyone has a job in the lineup, and I'm very comfortable with the number two hole here.
Watching what the number of spots that you've played, it certainly is incredibly valuable to a team. How do you like that? Because I would imagine that that's a real challenge for a player to not be certain which spot you're going to have to play or what you're going to do in the field on that given day.
Well, I mean, it eliminates redundancy, that's for sure. I can go out there and I know what position I'm playing in the game, and I can do that when I make sure I'm ready for that. And also, I know that I have to get reps in the outfield, or I have to get, you know, reps in a different part of the field. I mean, I like it. I think that if I have the ability to do it, then I should do it. I think there's more guys out there that can do it. I mean, you look at our team, and there's a bunch of guys that can do the same, you know, they can play different positions. And if you have the ability to do it, I think you should do it. It obviously got me into the lineup from the beginning. You know, I want our coaching staff to feel that they can throw me in there wherever, and I will perform, you know, defensively as well as they can, and then the hitting will come, and then they feel like they can, you know, just stick me in there wherever, and I'll be a good value to them.
Dylan, it's been so awesome to watch this start. I think we're all bummed that we're not able to be down there and to watch you guys play at T-Mobile Park, but you've been one of the real bright spots, and it's great to have baseball back. It's really fun, and we look forward to a chance to being able to meet you in person here in the near future. But in the meantime, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course, yeah. Thanks, guys, for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. That is Dylan Moore, who has been a power source for the Mariners early this season. 4 home runs already this year. The Mariners take on the Houston Astros. That's tonight. First pitch is at 6:00. Pre-game is at 5:00. We've also got the Professor John Clayton. He's going to be talking to Pete Carroll. That's at 11:30. And us, we're going to raise flags. That's coming up next.
From the pocket and flags everywhere.
Flag on the play.
Now there's a flag down.
Every morning at 9:45 with Danny and Gallant. Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen.
If the noise persists, the defense will be charged with a timeout.
Flag on the play.
It is that time. We all gather around. Figure out exactly what went on. And on Friday, it's a little extra happy, right?
Yes.
Everybody should be rolling downhill toward the weekend right about now. Day's getting going, but come on. We got a couple days off coming here. The Seahawks are back on the field playing football. Paul's going to be out there at practice. Let's go.
I can't wait.
Go,
this is my first time
first?
Out.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
I will go first. This is a flag I'm going to throw at myself. I did not know this was happening when I was taking my usual pot shots at random states in the Midwest, Nebraska, and Iowa. Things aren't going so well in Iowa, and honestly, I'm raising a flag for the people of Iowa. I've never heard of a derecho. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced. But this super storm hit Iowa a couple of days ago with winds of up to 112 miles per hour out there. Tore across eastern Nebraska, hit Iowa as well. So thinking about the people there, that was my first really quick flag. I constantly take shots at those two states. Just know I do it in good fun and want to get back to being able to do that. Also, I'm going to raise a flag to the Damian Lillard show. It has been so, so fun. I mean, I never thought that a team that can't play defense would become must-watch basketball for me, but that guy, he has been so fun over the last week. I tuned into this game last night, and there he is hitting a shot from half court, and the Blazers win another exciting game against the Nets to get into that play-in game against Ja Morant and the Memphis Grizzlies. Good for Damian Lillard. He deserved that win.
Everybody in Seattle likes Damian Lillard. He ethered the Oklahoma City Thunder last year. Like, just dusted him. Waved goodbye and watched their franchise then dissolve with Russell Westbrook being traded, Paul George being traded. He will have a soft spot in our hearts always because of that.
Despite being from Oregon, Danny?
He's from the Bay. He's very clearly in East Bay and then went to Weber State. He plays in Oregon. Yeah, we'll allow it. Despite his negligible current geographic location, I'm rooting for Damian Lillard. I'll be rooting for the Blazers in the playoffs. Rooting for him in the first round against the Grizzlies as well.
I will as well.
Jess.
Yes, I'm going to raise a flag for Matthew and Kelly Stafford, along with Kirby Smart, who's Georgia football coach's Georgia football's head coach, and his wife Mary Beth, who have all four of them have endowed a $500,000 program at the University of Georgia to focus on diversity, inclusion, equity, and social justice. A lot of people are reaching into their own pockets to do things like this, and at an institution of higher learning, it's good to see that it happening in places at a young age, just because these are things that I guess during my time in college weren't as heavily taught. And the Staffords contributed $350,000, with the Smarts donating the rest. That coming from Michael Rothstein of ESPN. So I don't think they were asked to do it. They did it out of their own hearts, and it's going to make a difference for the future.
Also, shout out to the Staffords. They've been through an awful lot. When Stafford was on the COVID reserve list, I was like, oh, man, not that for them, too. And then it turned out it was a false positive. I was relieved for them. They've been through a ton.
Yeah.
Best to he and his wife. I'm going to raise a flag toward almost cocky Russell Wilson. He's not quite cocky, but he's almost cocky. Why is he almost cocky? Because, well, he says something like this.
You know, I wake up thinking about being great, Larry.
Every time I hear it, it's the way you can tell he's kind of bared down.
You know, I wake up thinking about being great, Larry.
And it's shades of Ricky Bobby.
You know, I wake up in the morning, I piss excellence.
That's the next step. That's when he goes full cocky. That's when he's truly arrogant Russ. I wouldn't mind to see that.
No, I wouldn't either. And honestly, he deserves to be this way. He has had, in this locker room, guys who were looking at him over time and not even thinking about him with the proper respect that now I think he gets from across the National Football League. So good for you, Russ. Let your Mr. Unlimited side out.
I like the dorky side too, but I like the little bit cocky Russell. Lydia, the bright side of our show.
The
happy, sunshiny.
Because I feel like I'm going to be negative.
Yeah,
it's been
do
happening
it.
A lot this week. I don't know why, but I'm going to throw a flag on one Mr. Zach Plesac for one of the more terrible apologies I think I've seen in a while. I'm not sure you can even quantify it as an apology.
He didn't say sorry.
He did say sorry. That's true. But it.
No, he did not. I don't think he ever said he's sorry.
Okay, you're right. So then you can't even classify it as an apology. But whatever he released on Instagram yesterday, Danny, you've always said the mantra, don't Instagram live. Just don't Instagram
videos.
Don't do it. And I think that should be a rule moving ahead. for athletes, but all people, maybe, perhaps. Also, if you're going to make an apology video for a non-apology video for being unsafe, don't do it while doing something unsafe, like, hey, driving and not wearing your seatbelt properly. That might also work in your favor. And also, just take off the pinky ring for the video. I don't know. That's just a personal aesthetic choice on my part, but take off the diamond pinky ring when you're making an apology video.
He basically criticized the media for calling him a bad teammate and then proceeded to describe how he was a bad teammate. He's basically saying, like, they're calling me selfish and saying I'm a bad teammate because I broke the quarantine rules. He doesn't dispute that he broke them. Nobody got anything wrong. He just thinks it's bad that everybody's judged him that way. And then he has this sort of metaphorical question.
And I've had to take these nasal swabs, both negative. And I asked the doctor, you know, today, first off, what is a safe environment for us to be in? You know, because things are inevitable. You're going to see people. You're going to socially interact based on... You can't sit in a room all day is the truth of the matter. So I wanted to know how we can be safe and moving forward, how I can basically make sure no one else gets put at risk who are at high risk and danger.
Major League Baseball has literally told you that, Zach. Like, told you exactly what you need to do to make sure nobody that's high risk is put in danger. Like, they've spelled it out.
They literally wrote it for you, Zach.
I also like the whole, well, I get it because my mom's a nurse and my brother deals with diabetes, which is serious. But then also, your teammate was diagnosed with leukemia last year. Like, come on, dude. Immunocompromised teammate. Then you're saying that you're not a bad teammate?
Right. And you went out and did all that anyway. Like, even after that, like, and I know I shouldn't have gone out of the hotel, but I didn't really go. Like, I was just around 8. Come on. Plus the pinky ring. I don't know.
I kind of want to pull it off now.
The pinky ring. It is a diamond-studded pinky ring. It is everything that you want to think about. And him driving around the sun. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't care for that. That's a warranted flag, Lydia. That is going to do it for us. We want to thank Dylan Moore for joining us. The Professor John Clayton. Michael Bumpus, who was with us in the 8 o'clock hour. Jessamyn McIntyre and Lydia Cruz, who are the sunny side of our breakfast programming. And he's Paul Gallant, and maybe there will be forgiveness for him in the heartland of Iowa and Nebraska.
And he's Danny O'Neill, and I would like one more Kima Sivaran pun before we hit the road.
Yeah, well, sometimes you run the corner blitz and you get burned deep.
So long, farewell, have a great weekend. You'll hear us on Monday.